Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, an analytical document review service, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available whenever they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you hit download on your iPod, iPad, or any device or computer and hit play. Today, we get back into the ESI Bytes recording mode, and we're doing an interesting show on and highly topical on data privacy and security issues. This issue was brought to everyone's attention with the hacking of Target's systems last year, and many studies have shown the vulnerability of law firm security systems, which has made many lawyers doubly aware of the issue, not only as counselors, but also as potential victims to a hacking attack. Our guest for today's show is Jim Daly, who's an e-discovery attorney and pioneer in electronic discovery and data privacy law, who's worked for over 30 years in the field. Jim and I personally go way back to his appearance in my e-discovery board game Discovery Land in 2005, where he was the $100,000 bill, and at the time he was overseeing e-discovery at a large international law firm. Jim has had stints with several high-powered virtual e-discovery law firms and currently is a partner at Daly & Fay based in Kansas City. Jim's master's degree in information systems and the CIPP privacy certification, along with his legal credentials, allows him to help global clients develop practical solutions to records management, electronic discovery, and data privacy compliance challenges. He's one of the original Sedona Conference members and has written an incredible list of articles, books, and other thought leadership materials in the e-discovery world. Jim, great having you back on the show.
Glad to be here, Carl.
All right, so let's start right off. What do you think, Jim, are the primary targets with respect to data breaches and security incidents?
Well, Carl, a recent survey done by IBM in 2013 lists manufacturing, finance and insurance, information and communication, health and social services, and retail and wholesale as the major sectors where data is being targeted, both in terms of commercially available data and targets by nation states in terms of competitively sensitive data.
You know, we don't see law firms on that list, but we all hear about the risks of how law firms can be hacked, and many law firms now have chief information officers, of course, except in Texas, I might add. Should law firms rest easy because they aren't on the top five lists from IBM?
No, they really shouldn't, particularly large law firms or especially law firms that have a lot of competitively sensitive data of their clients. Clients need to be, in particular, very careful and prudent about how that data is being stored, because law firms have been described in a lot of recent articles as perhaps the weakest link in terms of electronic espionage, again, both from competitors and from other nations in terms of large-scale espionage. So law firms need to look at standards such as ISO standards and try to work closely with their clients, both from an ethical perspective in terms of their duty to maintain confidences and secrets of their clients, which could affect their ability to practice law, and from a liability perspective in terms of safeguarding this information so that it is not inadvertently or accidentally revealed.
Yeah, one would wonder how that would fall in a malpractice policy. That might make some interesting law.
Probably is an exclusion in the general malpractice, you know, policy for that, and that has given rise to a whole cottage industry of cybersecurity insurance, and premiums and are very significant there. But also there are many traps for the unwary in terms of what criteria and what kind of provisions you need in a cyber insurance security policy. I've written on that issue, and a number of others have written on that issue. So it's worth researching just what kind of policy and what kind of exclusions to avoid when you're trying to insure that cybersecurity risk. This goes to, this applies to law firms as well as businesses.
That could have been the most important words you spoke on the entire podcast for our listening audience. But so let's go back into the general topic of what types of data are lost in these attacks, according to 2013 and 2014 data.
Well, the top suspects and the usual ones, I guess you'd say, would be password theft, and then personal information such as name, email address, username, and personal address. Also, social security number, phone numbers, medical information, dates of birth, and credit card numbers. You know, this sort of information is most generally associated with account information, logon credentials, and the like. So this is the richest target for those that are seeking to obtain this information by improper means.
So it would be safe to say that generally hackers are looking for quick and easy sources of information. They're not generally doing e-discovery on the files they're hacking into. I know it's all dangerous.
That's right. They're very targeted. You know, to hack into an e-discovery environment, whether it's a review site or a hosted review facility, would be like looking for a needle in a haystack. And it really wouldn't be cost effective for hackers to do that. Rather, they're looking at the richest veins of information that they could then turn around and use in criminal enterprises or in competitively sensitive environments. There's one situation recently where the FBI did a sting operation on a Chinese national attempt on behalf of this company to seek very competitively sensitive information from a local company in Missouri, and it was quite involved in terms of both technical and non-technical intrusion techniques. So that's really the big concern.
Okay, well, I'll sleep better at night now since I do a bit of review. So what are the leading attacker motivations, according to some of the data you've seen?
You know, the first one, it was a little surprising to me, but studies, again, from 2013 indicate that the opportunistic hacker is probably the biggest volume of type of hacker that's out there in terms of motivation. That is to say, they see a target and they have an opportunity or become aware of an opportunity to seize that target. One example was out at a very well-known university in the West Coast where a student became aware that his user, his password for the university network was by default his last name and the year that his account was established. Well, based on that, this individual surmised that perhaps were a lot of students, maybe thousands or tens of thousands, that never bothered to change that default password because it wasn't required to be changed. Using that information, he was able to infiltrate email and non-email directories of a large number of students looking for this type of personal information, where they might have credit card information or other personal information that might be helpful in monetizing his efforts. The individual was caught and convicted, but it sure is a clear example of an opportunistic attack. The next in line, though, in terms of up to 23% of the attacks deal with industrial espionage, financial crime, terrorism, and data theft. Another 15% relate to dissatisfaction with an employer or, you know, disgruntled employees looking for a way to get back at an employer. 7% deal with social activism, civil disobedience, and another 6% miscellaneous in terms of motivations for attacks.
I might add here, you know, if going back into review, since that's my focus, you know, if you're underpaying dramatically your reviewers, you might cause that dissatisfaction and they might opportunistically see something.
Absolutely. In fact, some well-documented incidents in India that led a few years ago to a rather very rigid India data protection and privacy law, one that was so strict that there was a concern that it would, in essence, shut down the outsourced data review industry in India. Now, it was amended shortly after it was enacted. It was amended to provide exceptions in terms of offshore review in India, but the reason for the law had a lot to do with critical information, sensitive information being stolen from those types of review locations.
I'm on record a lot of times telling people I just think sweatshops are a bad idea for lots of reasons, including the data, but more to the point, you know, how can you expect people to do a great job when they're, you know, marginally paid? But that's not today's topic. This is another show probably. So let's talk about wanting to stop the loss of data. What can you do to stop it? And I guess you got to know what the primary causes of data breaches and security incidents are to stop it from happening.
Yeah, according to a 2014 Poneman Institute study, an independent study, you know, kind of the main types of attacks are malicious or criminal attacks, 42%, negligent employees or contractors, 30%, and system glitches, IT and business process failures, 29%. So that gives us a clue as to what holes need to be filled and where those holes are. You know, Forrester, you know, similar to Gartner and other analysts groups, have looked to insiders as the top sources of data breaches, with 36% of breaches caused by inadvertent or intentional misuse of data by employees. And you know, one key issue is really ignorance, that 42% of workforces receive any kind of training in information security and are even trained or educated not to put passwords on sticky notes, for example. 43% are completely unaware of the organization's current security policy, and this includes things like not sending competitively sensitive information from the work email account to a home email account, and the like.
I look around my office and I see piles of paper, and I realize I have made it very hard to steal information because only I know where the important documents are. So it's my own data privacy plan. Do we know what the primary patterns are in data breaches and security incidences, and how they occur?
Well, it is important to know the patterns, because then you can look at processes that are broad enough and deep enough to deal with all those patterns. You know, you mentioned the Target breach, which is a major one that's happened most recently, and that related to point of sale intrusions, and that's exactly what was involved. That's exactly what is involved in over 31% of the data breaches and security incidents. So it's the richest target of intrusions. And next come web application attacks, cyber espionage, cart skimmers, insider misuse, crimeware, you know, specific types of programs that Trojan horses and the like that are sent via email or other measure or other means, and then become resident on an individual's computer or network and report back information to whoever is seeking it. Physical theft and loss is one of the lower in frequency, 1% of the patterns, but still it's a very important one to think about and consider, because it's perhaps the weakest link in terms of corporate security.
So what are the key consequences of a data breach?
Well, loss of reputation, brand value, and marketplace image is huge. You know, it's often can be millions or hundreds of millions of dollars in loss of immediate stock value if you're named in an article in front of the Wall Street Journal, front page of the Wall Street Journal, in terms of a data breach incident. The notification costs alone, you know, for instance, Adobe's recent breach or the Sony breach a few years back, is a several million dollar event itself. The Poneman Institute estimates that the average data breach is about $5.4 million in cost, and in some cases much higher. Loss of time and productivity in IT and others trying to track it down, of course, attorney's fees and trying to help manage and do damage control. Lost customers, there's typically a large regulatory fine and then numerous lawsuits, including class action lawsuits in many cases, that are in the wake of these data breaches. And then, of course, to try to remediate these breaches, costs of very, very expensive technology, DLP systems, and all the issues that come with trying to lock down data in an environment where you're trying to, you know, where you're trying to make sales and the like. Those are all additional issues that affect the business.
You know, when you read all these horrible things that can happen, in particular the loss of reputation, it was interesting. I read in the Wall Street Journal, I think a couple of weeks ago, some analysts are saying, better not to do anything because, you know, largely a lot of the data that's taken is still not fully usable. You know, there's still pieces of encryption or, you know, it's unclear if they get actually data that they can use or if it's not available in other places, which I thought was interesting because you missed the big punch of, you know, the immediate, you know, punch of being in the Wall Street Journal. But God forbid, what happens if something bad happens? Does that turn into an even worse scenario?
Well, you know, good. Reasonable minds can differ as to how far to take it in terms of locking things down. And in a global economy, in an open marketplace, the more you lock down data, the harder it is to monetize that data. I mean, when you look at Google, Facebook, I mean, no one pays to be on Google or Facebook. They're making their money by monetizing the data that's mined and the analytics that flow from having that data. So when the data itself has become a currency and a thing of value, locking it down too much takes away that additional entrepreneurial and marketing type of an outlet and opportunity.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. This brings to mind a conversation I have with a lawyer, and when I was out talking about our newer review models, and they said, well, what do we do about the intellectual property of the review methodology if you have reviewers jumping around between projects and things like that? And I said, do you really think you've got competitive advantage in this area, number one? But number two, that's what competition is. It's looking ahead. Not, you know, you try to protect what you can as long as you can, obviously. But if you're not pushing ahead trying to grow, you know, that lockdown mentality is what we call the Soviet Union economic plan of the 1970s, you know. It doesn't grow. You don't create growth. So I hear loud and clear what you're saying about cost versus growth.
Yeah, so. It is postulated that so much of the corporate cyber security breaches originate in China because they have such a closed system where there isn't a lot of diversity of thought permitted and not a lot of incubators where different things can be tried. Where you have a closed society like that, you know, how do they grow? They, in many cases, have to borrow or steal or sometimes buy, but... that kind of innovation and you know, product development that is generated elsewhere, and so yeah, that's a key differentiator between in many cases the United States and a number of other countries that don't have as much openness. Now, with that openness comes additional risks, of course, and additional balancing act, which is different in terms of, you know, the risk of lack of privacy versus the benefits of being able to do, you know, behavioral marketing and profiling.
Yep. So what industries have the highest data breach costs?
Well, there's a whole list, but I would give you the top five are healthcare, education, pharmaceutical, financial, and communications. You know, those top five really have anywhere from a per capita, you know, so per employee cost per breach of around $350 down to $177 per individual per breach. And that, obviously, that figure is quite large when you consider a company with 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 employees or more. And it's pretty easy to understand why those are the top five. I mean, healthcare and pharmaceutical, for example, you've got very personally sensitive information that could be used and mined, and social security numbers as well as credit card numbers in terms of payment are often involved. Education is a big one, again, in terms of that personal biographical data that is, for instance, students at Harvard, being able to breach personal sensitive information that is long-lasting and enduring for individuals could be a gift that keeps on giving. Financial, of course, it's not only an issue in terms of the cost of the breach, but it's an issue in terms of reputation. Because if you can't trust your banks to keep your information private, or insurance companies, for example, who can you trust? Once that trust is lost, then the whole basis for the value and brand, brand currency of the company is lost. Communications, we've seen with the NSA revelations and others that there's a lot of breaches going on in the communications industry, not just by competitors or other nation states, but even by the United States. I'd recommend to all the listeners, if they haven't seen it already, to watch a very well-balanced presentation on Frontline, available on the Frontline website, called United States of Secrets. And, it's a pretty interesting and in-depth examination of this kind of, surveillance, both here and abroad, post 9/11, under many different administrations. So that's definitely worth a listen.
Now, I know you don't have the study, and you may not have the study in front of you, but I'm just sort of curious how that math would work. If it's $359 per capita, is that $359 for a healthcare company times its total number of employees, or times the number of people that are impacted? I was just curious how that would sort of play out.
Great question. And I think a little bit more detail is helpful here. It's not just per employee, but it's per record per employee. So, so it's one record by one employee lost would be $359, but employees generally have care, custody, and control of hundreds, sometimes thousands of records, sometimes even more. So we're really talking about a per capita cost related to each record that is breached. And, of course, employees come into play because they're most often the custodians of these records. Now, it's not always the case. Sometimes these records aren't really breached in the hands of employees, but rather they're breached from database systems. And while those database systems are administered by certain employees, obviously the breadth of the records goes well beyond one individual or even one department.
Jim, after doing 9 courses across the country last year on predictive coding and statistics, I just want to compliment you on handling the math question that was completely not in the outline perfectly. You always love those. But thanks for, I was reading and I didn't follow those numbers. So thanks for the clarification. What are the key factors that increase the costs associated with the data breaches? And I think you might have covered some of that in your earlier answer, but maybe if you want to expand on it.
Well, I think whenever you have lost or stolen devices, lost iPad, lost laptop with sensitive information, that can really impact the per record cost of the data breach. Act too fast by rushing to do a notification to the press, to individuals affected, without a thorough assessment and a forensic examination, that can add additional costs. So it takes really often a very thorough investigation to learn the full scope of a data breach. The worst thing you can do is quickly announce a breach and have that information incorrect or incomplete. So that can greatly increase the cost. And, forensic consultants, if you have to engage forensic consultants very deeply, that's a huge cost as well and spikes up the cost of an individual data breach.
Okay. So in general, what are the key factors in reducing the costs associated with a data breach?
Well, having a very good disaster recovery business continuity management system that can help remediate a breach is very important. So you can identify just where the holes are and how to best plug those holes. Having a good, solid organizational info security group in your organization can often reduce the cost per record of data breach by as much as $20 per record. Having a formal incident response plan and an incident response team can, again, significantly reduce the cost of a breach on a per record basis. And many companies have even gone to hiring a corporate information security officer, also known as a CISO, who can lead the data incident breach response team and can further significantly reduce the cost of data breaches by quick action if one is discovered. Oftentimes the issue is that the breach isn't discovered until quite a long time after it has occurred. And the longer that breach has been in place and basically the longer records have been hemorrhaging from the organization, the harder it is to remediate and the harder it is to return to a more secure environment. If you've got a governance structure already in place, along with policies, practices, and procedures that can be administered by this governance group, then you're in a much better position to be aware of those breaches early and to close them down with minimal damage and cost.
So what actions are believed to be the most helpful in reducing the negative consequences of a data breach?
Well, Carl, this may sound a bit self-serving, but the studies actually indicate that retaining outside legal counsel is often a key to reducing those costs. Why? Because experienced outside counsel that deal with these...
Would that legal counsel be Jim Daly? Could be, right?
My firm, but any number of firms that have worked with the corporate sector in actually dealing with these corporate data breaches. Because we often know in advance what the likely claims would be by those seeking to sue the company. We would be more likely to know immediately those regulatory standards that people are subject to, whether it's FTC standards or PCI DSS standards that are related to handling of credit card information, and therefore have a better sense of how to prioritize what the response is. Messaging is also important in timing in terms of notification of customers or individuals whose data has possibly been compromised, but also in terms of dealing with regulatory authorities. There is large importance to, as I stated before, doing that very careful assessment of what is the harm to the victims, and is it a data breach that rises to the level that broad notification has to be given, or can a more narrow notification be given to specific individuals? And then what's the form of that notification? All those things are very helpful in reducing the negative consequences of the data breach. You know, I think it's been a key to some of the situations that have happened in recent years that the lack of these kinds of efforts have resulted in a large number of class actions and lawsuits being filed against, for instance, Target, Heartland Payment Systems, Sony Corporation, and the like. And the Target brand's breach, itself is estimated to cost between $400 million to $1 billion to deal with. And to date, about 140 lawsuits, including class action lawsuits, have been filed on a number of different legal theories and claims, including federal, state, and common law allegations. So it's really important to try to be prepared in advance, try to have your team in place, and to include in that team in terms of response and damage control and experienced outside counsel. Oftentimes, a PR consultant can be very helpful too in terms of framing the message when it comes time to actually report the incident to individuals affected and to the public and to regulators.
You know, I was joking when I mentioned you being, a likely person to call. I was thinking through your background, and we did a podcast a few years ago on international data concerns, because I know you're a very substantial expert in that space as well, do a lot of work international on data security. Does this issue get even more complex when you're talking about data internationally that is somehow hacked into and gotten access to by outsiders?
It does get more complex very quickly, and largely because both the processing or use of that data as well as the transfer of the data are very highly regulated by the European Union and many other countries throughout the world. In those cases, there are very heavy fines and penalties for breaches and additional notification provisions. But unlike in the U.S., where we have a lot more openness to the mining and the analysis of personal data generally, because when you sign up for a raffle at your local grocery store, that data is going to be, in many cases, sold and transferred onward several times. But in the European Union and a number of other countries where there are stronger restrictions on the use and onward transfer of that data, there also is greater sensitivity to your personal privacy as a fundamental human right. You're even higher status than a constitutional right here in the United States, but a fundamental human right that outweighs the interests of litigants on the other side trying to seek information that they might need to prosecute a lawsuit or defend a lawsuit. It outweighs in many cases the interests of the governmental organization. It outweighs in many interests the interests of international commerce, the free flow of commerce. So those laws and regulations really have to be taken into account, and the data privacy and data security implications need to be considered. The term that's most often used in the European Union and other countries outside the U.S. is data protection, that personal data has a right to be protected, and that right belongs to individual data subjects. And who are they? They are the people who are named or whose information is in data. Could be as simple as their name, or could be an identifying number that could be traced to the individual. But certainly that personally identifiable information is treated much differently outside the U.S. than inside the U.S. There are different notions of jurisprudence at play, different notions of individual rights, different notions of law and privacy at play.
You know, I'm looking at the next question. I think you covered a lot of it, unless you want to go into a little bit more detail on to what extent differences between, you know, in prevalence on the changes that are most commonly implemented by organizations and, you know, what steps are commonly taken to address vulnerabilities after the data breach.
Yeah, I think we have covered those in large part. You know,
you want to just go into your top 10 list then for critical steps that a corporation should take now to reduce their risks and costs of data breaches? Good wrap-up question.
That sounds good, Carl. And I think number one, we've talked about a fair amount already, and that is identifying your data privacy and security team and, you know, getting your top-down management buy-in, because you've got to have some kind of it's got to be some kind of a standing group rather than an ad hoc group with internal and external pieces in play. Internally, your legal, compliance, IT, IS, HR, and communications groups. Externally, your outside counsel, and potential electronic forensic consultants and potential public relations assistants. Step two is, you know, conducting your regular data privacy and data security risk assessments. These are required of a number of companies that handle and store a lot of personally identifiable information both here and abroad. And they are going to become a regular requirement if the EU regulation is passed, which currently is winding its way through the European Parliament, and which will be the replacement for the current EU Data Protection Directive. Those regular data privacy and risk assessments, data privacy and data security risk assessments will be required. Step three is to try to minimize the type of personally sensitive data that you do collect, access, or retain. For example, if you're an insurance company and you need certain information from insurers that does not include personal information, then taking steps in your business agreements and in your intake of that information to filter out that can solve a number of downstream problems that would result when that transfer might inadvertently occur, and it occurs more often than you might think. So limit opportunities for access of personal data from external sources. Try to promptly return unneeded data, securely dispose of unnecessary data or data that has become stale. That's required by the FACTA legislation that requires destruction of credit card information 1 year after it's no longer active. Minimizing access to personal data, you know, restricting credentials, both physical and technical credentials, and access to only those with a need to know within the organization. Transfer data only when absolutely necessary. For example, in the litigation context, you don't want to transfer huge amounts of email from, say, Germany to U.S., but only email that has been pre-filtered and in many cases reviewed in-country and found to be extremely relevant for a particular lawsuit. And, of course, try to, this is in general a good practice, try to dispose of information when it's no longer needed for business or legal reasons. And if you can do that, have a good, solid information management process, that will reduce your risk of data privacy and data security breaches. Adopting policies and procedures, like the incident response policy and procedures, are important. Training of individual employees that have any occasion to be in contact with personal data is very important. Distributing access, so having several layers in terms of security access and controls about handling the personal data is important. So, for instance, don't give one individual all the keys of the kingdom in terms of the intake of the data, storage of the data, use of the data, and deletion of the data. Have several checks and balances involved, both human and technological. Try to be proactive in terms of combating mobile threats, you know, threats that come in by way of smartphones or BYOD devices, and try to establish really strong controls on lost or stolen devices. You know, there are some technologies like, for instance, Mocha 5, which creates a protected space on a mobile device and can be remotely wiped very easily. And if that device doesn't actually sync up with a central server within a certain amount of time, it can be wiped by default. So those are some things that can be very, very helpful, as well as the procedures for destruction of personal data when it's no longer needed. You know, if it's paper, secure shredding or incineration, if it's electronic, you know, permanent wiping, degaussing, or actual destruction of the magnetic media with that information. And I think the last point would be continuous quality improvement, because technology is going to change. The ways in which data is used, analyzed, will change. Policies, practices, and procedures need to be fluid and dynamic. They need to be responsive to those sorts of changes in terms of the reality of personal data being used and threats to that personal data in terms of how it's received, how it's stored, how it's processed, and how it's destroyed.
Okay, any last suggestions on where you might be able to look for more information on data privacy and security?
Well, we have a number of articles we've written and would be happy to share those with individuals. They can reach out to me at jdaily@dailylegal.com or by phone at 913-522-8901. And as well, I would highly recommend that they check out an organization I've been involved in for quite some time, which is the International Association of Privacy Professionals, or IAPP. Yeah, I think it's one of the premier organizations in terms of keeping its users abreast of data breaches and data security issues worldwide on a very real-time basis, you know, with eBlast that keep us all informed, those of us that deal these issues on a day-to-day basis and as professionals. So that's certainly an organization for folks to consider. And I believe just Google IAPP and you'll be able to find access to that organization very quickly.
Great. Well, thank you, Jim, for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have guests like you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support and hosting of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can remember the show and website phonetically. It sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.